When you go into mines, it's multinational companies. When you go into banks, it's multinational companies. When you go into monopoly industries, it's multinational companies. We cannot even own and protect our own agricultural sector with our fertile land in Africa. Because Europe and the entire developed countries use Africa and South Africa as a dumping site. Every lower grade food get to be dumped in our countries, undermining our own agriculture. When we say those things, we are called communist, we are called anarchist, we are called radicals, because we must continue to bow before a white supremacist. We're refusing that. We're refusing to bow before imperialism and colonialism. We want a total control of our own country and our own land.
The voice of Julius Malema, the leader of the Economic Freedom Fighters, a political party in South Africa, in an address at the Oxford Union in 2016. South Africa was one of the last countries to achieve independence from colonial rule. And any history class will tell you that the second half of the 20th century was the era of liberation for most of the countries that were under the yoke of colonialism. But just how free have those countries really been? Is it possible that the name and the mechanism may have changed, but the power imbalance and the undue influence have remained the same? Welcome. You're listening to the State of Power podcast from the Transnational Institute. I am your host, Sean Macheza. Here at the State of Power podcast, we're interested in how power functions, how it mutates, and how it shapes the world around us. We believe that if we are to understand the present, we need to put it in its proper historical context and try to understand the historical processes that have led us here. This is the third and final episode of our three-part series in which we look at how Europe and its offshoots came to be dominant globally. In the first episode, we looked at racism and how it was used to justify European imperialism. In the second, we took a closer look at how colonialism unfolded. And today, I continue my conversation with Roger van Swanenburg, who is the founder of Pluto Books, an independent publisher of radical left-wing non-fiction books. He's written a new global history called Wealth and Power, which he's sharing in a series of blogs, a link to which you can find in the podcast description. Roger's work traces the roller coaster story of the past 500 years or so of human history, focusing on how Europe and its offshoots amassed great wealth and power at the expense of the rest of the world. In today's episode, we explore how wealth and power manifest in the contemporary world. How does power play out today? I began by asking Roger if the contemporary world built after the Second World War is in any way fundamentally different from the brutal past that we have outlined in our discussion in the first two episodes.
That is the nub of the basic question. Did the world change after 1945 when the Americans took over world power? Did that sufficiently change both the colonialism of the previous 450 years and the racialism, which was the ideology which justified what they were doing? My argument would be that that was, if you like, the first stage of a great imperial world power. And what happened was that in 1945, when the war ended, the Americans had all the gold and everybody else owed them very large sums of money. And they used the nuclear bomb in 1945 to destroy Japanese cities. not because they wanted to defeat Japan. Japan was already defeated. But the nuclear bomb illustrated to the rest of the world who was the greatest and most powerful country on Earth.
And so it's possible to say that the nuclear bomb was used almost symbolically. It wasn't a strategic decision.
It was more than that. It also was an illustration to the Russians that if they try to expand their control of the parts of the world they already controlled, there was a nuclear bomb that could be thrown at them. So they used the nuclear bomb to symbolize that they were the dominant power in the whole of the world. Mm-hmm. So that was the start of the period. The second element of it was that they had a choice. They could have cooperated with the USSR. Mm-hmm. President Roosevelt, who was the president at the end of the war, was of a mind to do exactly that. And he worked with his second in command. And they were planning to work with the USSR. But he died in 1945. And President Truman took over. And with it, they scrapped the plan to destroy Germany and Japan. They planned to break up Germany into many parts so that it would never become an industrial country again. And this all changed with President Truman becoming the president. And they created the Marshall Plan. And out of the Marshall Plan, Germany and Japan rose again very fast indeed as major industrial states.
So, but now they were sort of cooperating with the US and Britain, right?
They were because of the Marshall Plan. They were cooperating. Britain and Europe had no choice. They were devastated and they were deeply in debt. So they had absolutely no choice. But to cooperate with the Americans. And the Marshall Plan was designed to provide the necessary dollars for the entire area to get its act together and to re-industrialize. So that was the beginning of the new era. And my argument is this new era was new, but at the same time, it was a continuation of the past.
Uh-huh. So let's talk about this new era, like really break it down. What was new about it and what were the elements from the past that carried over into the contemporary world?
It's actually quite useful, I think, to look at Machiavelli as a prince. He described three options of how a conquering nation or power might treat the states that it defeated. There were the first ones. The first one was to utterly ruin them. The second
one... destroy them.
destroy them completely. And I will come on to that because the USA has been doing that more recently. The next was to actually reside there in person, or which was the old colonial policy. Which was
so settling the place.
Yeah, they took up their people. The colonial powers actually ran the countries that they colonized. So that was a colonial one. And the third option was to permit them to live under their own laws, and they would draw tribute, establishing within it an oligarchy who was to be kept friendly. And this third option was the option that the Americans first chose to run the world. And many of these countries thought that meant that they could actually choose who they wanted to have in power, and they could choose how they would run their society. So they could actually choose to be a socialist government.
They could choose to be a socialist government as long as there would be a socialist government in service of American interests.
Well, you could put it like that, but actually anything which smelt of socialism.
That's what I was thinking, yeah.
the Americans would want to stop immediately. Let me explain how the system worked. And I'll come back to Machiavelli because he's a very useful. First of all, they set up the World Bank and the IMF and the World Trade Organization. These were organizations which would control the financing of the world in the policies designed by the Americans. And there would always be an American who would be either at the head of the World Bank and a European who they approved of at the head of IMF. And these were the banks which would provide finance, which would help countries to develop, so-called. But they had to follow the rules set out by the American governments. So that was, if you like, a very, very briefly put, the mechanism for controlling the world of the currency. At the same time, they created the gold standard with the US dollar, so that instead of the pound sterling being the currency of world exchange, the dollar became, and that's a very important tool of the conquering power in a world like our own.
Would you say that was the moment of the overthrow of British hegemony? I mean, there must be many, but then that was a very significant change, wasn't it?
The British have never accepted, at least in public, that their own hegemony has been overthrown. But there was one case in 1954 when the British, alongside the French and the Israelis, invaded the Suez Canal. And the Americans instructed them to withdraw and tell them that this was not an acceptable activity. And it was, in fact, the actual visual end of Britain and France as major great powers. But in practice, it has not been accepted in public, and the British always talk about the special relationship they have with the Americans, which the Americans always use and abuse, but it's not the case. The Americans are the dominant world power, have been since 1945, and there are a number of very important tools that they created to maintain their world dominance. And it's these tools which are under competition at the moment.
And so they're still being used until today. And I want to hear more about these tools of global domination.
First of all, any leader who appeared to be a threat to American dominance was assassinated. And there are many examples of assassination. Assassination became a tool in the American bag of activities, which was always available to them. There was Allende in Chile, there was Walter Rodney, there was Romero in San Salvador, there was Bishop in Grenada, and Patrice Lumumba in the Congo, and so on and so on. And to this day, assassination is part of the tool bag of the American system. Now, it appears that they also used it within their own people who they thought were threatening the direction they wanted to take.
Even internally in America.
Internally, yes. There's Malcolm X, there's Martin Luther King, there's John Kennedy and Robert Kennedy. They were all assassinated. And do we know who did it? We don't. And we don't because it was probably work from within. And so what you have to see is how, what mechanisms, what forms they created. And I just want to talk a little bit about the CIA. The CIA are a different organization to what most countries set up to provide secret intelligence.
How so?
Because the CIA are different from, for instance, the British MI5 or MI6, because they are also a military organization. They organize military coups, they organize invasions, and they are part of the military toolkit that the Americans use worldwide. And I'll give you a few examples. The first overthrow of a government was Iran. And the Iranians, of course, have never forgotten it. And the particular government wasn't particularly of the left, but it was a nationalist government, and they had nationalized the oil industry in Iran. And so they overthrew Mossadegh, and they provided the Shah of Iran as an alternative. And the question of coups comes up again and again. There was in Indonesia, was one particular case, again in the 60s, when they overthrew Sukarno, and they killed between 500,000 and 1 million of the people who were part of the Communist Party of Indonesia.
Wow.
Yeah, huge, huge.
So this is all adding up to on the atrocities that we've already spoken about before, where there's an entire annihilation of the people in America, and then now it's that same violence and aggression is projected outwards, and not even in terms of warfare, but actual underhanded intervention in all these places.
Yeah. This is correct. I think what you have to understand is that America was a conquering power. It saw itself coming as the new world order, as the power which was going to control the world. And of course, like all great powers, it provides and still provides a whole array of ideological tools around freedom and around democracy, which makes it appear to many people as a successful political order. But Machiavelli's point was that as a conquering power, it would take a number of decisions on how to deal with other powers which would not adhere to the principles on which it wanted to work the world. What I'm talking about are the various means that the United States has taken over the last 80 odd years, or since 1945, that's what that's 85 years. And then there's the invasions. And the invasions are more recent since the end of the Soviet period. You've got the invasions of Afghanistan, Iraq, Somalia, Syria, and these, the early invasions of Korea and Vietnam, which were highly unpopular. These new invasions are what Machiavelli would describe as to ruin them. And what America has done to Iraq and Syria, and to some extent to Libya as well, is to ruin these societies. As to
and is this are you suggesting that this ruination is deliberate? Because in the news, you always hear, well, we're trying to do this. We're trying to bring democracy. We're trying to fix these communities to bring them into the modern world. Whereas actually, the failure is planned.
Well, that's very much more difficult to answer with a surety. Because nobody is.
But it does look that way.
We intended to lay these countries flat. But what happened, whether it was intentional or not, these countries have been destroyed. Absolutely. They were developing. They were all, particularly Iraq, Libya, and Syria, were all developing quite significantly. There were freedoms for women. There was there was medical development for everybody. There was education, and all this is gone. This is all absolutely been destroyed. So,
essentially, with all these societies that you're mentioning, they were better off before they got freedom and democracy, American style.
Absolutely. I was, as you know, a publisher, and I used to go to these societies looking for authors. So I haven't been to Iraq, but I've been to Syria and Libya. And they were, you could walk around at night feeling that nobody was about to attack you. They were decent human societies, and there was a lot going on for the people. Their lives were improving. And today, that is all gone.
And there's so many parallels here when you talk about the ideology of US imperialism. When you think of Britain and other European powers, when they went out with their colonial mission, where they were civilizing the natives, civilizing these savage nations that they were bringing modernity to. And in the same vein, you've got America now democratizing. It sounds like pretty much a different name for the same project in a way.
You could describe it that way. I think that is too close a parallel to be correct.
Yeah. See,
in the colonial period, the colonizing country actually ran the government of the countries they had colonized. And that meant that they had unique control over the resources and the import and export of goods and money and so forth. In this new era, where it is relatively open to the import and export, what America wants is to have access for its major companies to exploit the resources of these countries and to be able to take the profits out of the country. And therefore, this is the surplus on which they would be able to develop. So they keep the countries which they have control over poor, except for the people who are running them. And the people who are running them, who are the indigenous people, and many people would say, much better to have your own leaders than to have foreign leaders. And that may be so. And I can well understand that particular point. But the way this system works is that the leaders of any one country, which Angola is a prime example of a country which is rich in oil resources and where the leaders are hugely wealthy. But they are friends of the Americans because the Americans have access to the resources and to the investment in those countries. So that's the way this
is. It's really such an ongoing, and you see it's across the board. I mean, I'm from Zimbabwe, as you well know, and you always hear these conversations, people saying, well, the British colonialists were better because at least the water worked, the roads didn't have potholes, and now you have this new local elite, and they are super wealthy. I mean, somebody bought a Bugatti Chiron just the other day, but there's no water coming out of the taps. And this is the same across the board. If you look at former French colonies as well, I think it's very much the same, where you have this local elite that is super wealthy, fantastically wealthy, and the local people are really poor. And this is by design.
This is indeed by design. But wealth and poverty are the very nature of the system of capital. And indeed, it's by design, but it is also the same in the it's the same in the United States. The levels of poverty are huge. The numbers of people,
indeed,
who need for food or housing or health is in many millions, and that is not an exaggeration. So the campaigns of terror, which were designed to control the growth of socialism in its different forms, was particularly the case in Latin America. Let me just give you another example, because it's in the 70s and 80s, they developed a campaign called Operation Condor. And it was a campaign run by local people. It was a campaign of terror. It involved kidnapping, torture, and murder. And it targeted guerrillas and Marxists. And it was continental wide. And it was run with the support of the Americans, who created a School of Americas, which was military training in torture and counterinsurgency. So Condor comes out of their experience in Vietnam, and is part of the, again, the tool bag of being the dominant world power. So I come back to the very beginning, which is, the world changed in 1945. It changed radically. But at the same time, it changed. It was version two of the old colonial system. And therefore, you need to see the two together to understand what a voracious animal it is to use the resources of the world to keep your own wealth and develop your own wealth. As much as possible.
So you've got this this military might that's being projected. You've got, as you mentioned, the assassinations, both domestic and foreign, of leaders who are going against this system. You've got actual coups being fostered in different places like Iran, and you've got actual invasions where the United States, via its CIA, actually invades other countries. That's sort of one pillar, right? You mentioned the World Bank and the IMF as another element. Could you perhaps go a little bit deeper into that?
Yes, I could. The system of finance and across the world requires both a currency, which is dominant, and a system of banking, which is the only system available. And if you come to the US dollar, if you have been in business anywhere in the world, you will know that you can trade in dollars. People trust dollars to keep their value. And so, owning and controlling the dollar has been very, very important for the USA. And what that means is that country X, who wants to trade, needs to have more dollars than it has in its bank. So it borrows those dollars from America. America then manufactures those dollars out of nothing.
I've been here.
And you've been there before. And then those dollars have to be kept in the United States, in a bank in the United States. Then when that same country steps out of line and the Americans impose sanctions against that country, those dollars can then be frozen so that the country can't use them. Iran, Russia have those sorts of sanctions imposed on them now.
Zimbabwe as well, huh?
I imagine Zimbabwe has as well, but and that could well be the case, that some of the poorest countries in the world have their foreign currency, which they have to pay interest on, are kept frozen so they can't use them for whatever reason that the Americans decide, because they are the dominant power and they can choose who they will do that to and who they won't. So that's the first arm of that system. The second arm is the IMF and the World Bank. The IMF is for relatively short-term loans, and the World Bank are for very large loans indeed, like the building of dams. A country wants to trade, comes to the IMF because it is short of currency, of dollar currency, and the IMF says, yes, we will lend you money, but first of all, you must close your trade unions. You must make the following companies free to be bought and sold. You must allow foreign companies to come into your country, and you must allow them to export their profits as free as you want to. Otherwise, you won't get any money. And of course, many of these smaller countries absolutely have to have the money because they want to import oil and they want to import food and other necessities. So the World Bank and IMF provide a mechanism of control of other countries' economies, which only a dominant country could do.
So they're not objective, because this is kind of what I feel needs to go out there more and be better known, that these are not objective institutions where democratically people came together and said, let us build a bank for the world, let us build a monetary fund for the world. It is rather very specifically created to achieve particular purposes.
Yes. I mean, when you use the word democratic, the only type of democracy that is ever used in the Western world, at any rate, is to appoint the people who will lead the government and who are supposed to represent the people. The other institutions, the great institutions of our time, of which the World Bank and IMF are just two examples, they have no democratic element in them at all.
The United Nations?
The United Nations is something else again. Let's leave that on one side. Just a moment, I'll come back to the United Nations. The World Bank and the IMF are simply extensions of US and European world power. And they're designed for that purpose. And they have been ever since they were first initiated, which was at Bretton Woods in 1944. They were created at that point in time, which was the Bretton Woods Agreement, was the moment when the Americans actually took over the world economy. And they're still with us now. And they're in every small country in the world. The United Nations is a different body, and it is a much more democratic body, and it has many representations of the rest of the world, which the World Bank and IMF don't have. The United Nations is extremely powerful and important in epidemics like the one we are just coming out of in this country, but many countries not coming out of, because they have a global medical system, which they can then advise countries around the world. So there's many useful elements in the United Nations, and that's just one of them, which everybody has seen in recent days. But in famines, the United Nations is a key component of the world to try and persuade governments to provide funds to feed people who are dying of hunger. So the United Nations is really quite a different body to the ones I've been talking about.
But yeah, I just mentioned it because, yeah, it's still kind of, I mean, for someone who doesn't understand exactly how the United Nations works, you still think of the fact that you've got a Security Council and that sometimes America doesn't toe the line with everybody else, and they sort of have their own special rights within the United Nations. But yeah, I think indeed that's a too deep a topic to get into at the moment. Looking at time now, I was just thinking what I want to draw out of this conversation is indeed, as you've pointed out, that the world as it is today is a sort of a continuation of this process that began, say, in the 15th century, right, with Europe discovering the New World and coming up with the way of exploiting and getting the world to themselves. And then you've got America rising, and you've got now this contemporary world that we look at. And when people think, well, there's a lot of injustice here. There are a lot of things that are not right. But then the argument is, well, it's the way it is. But my mission is to show people that people created it. People created the system that we're living in. And so people can dismantle it. And the unfortunate part is the same system that people created really has at its core, I don't know, maybe this is only, it's colored by my own experience of the world, the racial order of things, the fact that is the wealthy countries are European. If they're not European, they're European extensions. Think Australia, think New Zealand, think Canada, think the United States. And the continued extraction of resources still goes in one direction. And everything that we've spoken about buttresses this system. Do you agree with this analysis? And what can we do? How can we use this knowledge now to help us understand the world today and perhaps change it?
you ask a very difficult question. Indeed. How can we use this knowledge to change it? Well, first of all, we need to be clear about how the world is designated and not be fooled by the ideologies which are thrown at us every day of the week. The original colonial edifice was justified on the fact that they were bringing civilization. And it was believed by nearly everybody who was involved in the colonial activities that they were bringing civilization. Today, nobody gives that much credence. It's obviously ideology. It was obviously used to justify what the colonialists were trying to do. And today we have a whole set of ideological tools which are very difficult to handle because they appear to be correct. It appears that we can change our own government by voting for different people. Mm-hmm. But if you find somebody in one of our systems, like Jeremy Corbyn, he was hounded out of being the leader of a party, which in fact threatened the local order, the order of things. And a whole range of lies were told about him, which were repeated by the media day after day until everybody believed it. But they remained as lies. But there was no way that he was not a good enough leader to be able to overcome it. So he was destroyed. And so there's a whole way of dealing with these sorts of things. At the moment, we are dealing with the question of China. Mm-hmm. China's, if I can just very quickly say, China's standard of living has doubled every 10 years for the last 40 years. So every 10 years, people's standard of living doubles. In the same period of time, in the Western nations, the majority of people haven't increased their standard of living hardly at all. Now, we are in a fight almost to the death with China. China is the threat. They are being successful. They have taken 800 million people out of poverty. So what do? We find a whole range of issues which we batter our people with, from the issues on Hong Kong or the questions in the mountain regions of Tibet, or the peoples on the borders of Afghanistan,
the Uyghur people.
Yes, the Uyghur people. And we batter our own people with what terrible things are happening there. Again, most of it, but not quite all of it, but most of it are lies. And it is simply a use of ideology, because the people who are leading this country, the people who are leading the world, who have the wealth, are threatened by China. China is a success story of capitalism, and ours is not. And it's as simple as that. So what can we do about it? How can we make our world a better place? That is a very difficult question to answer in 2 minutes, and I'm not going to try. one of the things I've tried to do is to understand our past. And if we understand our past as it really was, then we have some chance of persuading our young people that a better world is possible. And of course, a better world is possible. Our availability of wealth and our ability to distribute that wealth in a fair and equitable way is, of course, possible. But it's not possible under our present leaders.
Wow. Yeah. Thank you so much, Roger. This is like the importance of the work that you're doing. I would like to, again, for our listeners to say they really have to go look at wealthandpower.org, because understanding history from an honest perspective and understanding how things actually occurred is, I think, the beginning to us actually having a firmer foundation of building a better world. Because as you put it, one of the saddest things for me is indeed that there is enough for everyone, but somehow we've set it up in this skewed way where you've got such just terrible poverty aligned with the most fabulous wealth humankind has ever seen. The work is still continuing. The work is cut out for us. Before we sign out, are there any other aspects that you wanted to bring out? Just final thoughts?
I think I've said enough, actually. I wonder if I'm clear enough so that people understand the way the world is working. I would say that if people want to understand, for instance, how the CIA operated, have a look at the book by Norman Mailer called Harlot's Ghost. Mm-hmm. It's a fantastic, it's a great read, and you get an insight how the system actually works. It's a superb book, and I thoroughly recommend that sort of reading. But anyway, thank you very much for giving me the opportunity to express these ideas. So thank you very much.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Roger. Hope to have you back again very soon for another episode.
The present reeks of the past. The world we live in is not the result of some natural law. It was created by people like you and I, humans, who walked, breathed, ate, and drank. The contemporary world is a result of people making decisions. Decisions that would give them more power, access to more wealth, and grant them the influence to safeguard their wealth and power. If they could make it, you and I can unmake it. This is an invitation to imagine a different world and to strive for it daily. Thank you for listening this far. I've been your host, Sean Macheza, in conversation with publisher and historian, Roger van Zwanenburg. Roger's blog is available online, and a link is in the podcast description. This episode is the last of three episodes on wealth and power in global history since the 15th century. TNI's material is all free, but we would greatly appreciate your help to keep doing the work we do. If you'd like to find out more about how you can boost TNI's work, please click on the Support TNI tab on our website, tni.org. If you have specific questions, requests, or suggestions for the podcast, please send an email to podcast@tni.org. We'd greatly appreciate it if you could take a moment to give us a rating or a review on whichever platform you're receiving the podcast from. Or please share us with your friends. An endorsement will help us to reach more people, and your feedback will help us to create better content for you. You can also find us on social media at TN Institute on Twitter and Transnational Institute on Instagram and Facebook. Thank you, and see you next time.